We're in Chatwick Heath, and we're here as part of our Ask Somerset's Plants project, which is looking at plants as a resource for humans to think about their problems a little bit differently. So people from Somerset and further afield have sent in questions that they are trying to answer, or problems that they're trying to solve and that they've been struggling with. And instead of looking to the normal sources, we're going to ask the plants what knowledge and what wisdom they might have for us to solve these questions. I'm Feral Practice, and I'm here with Marcus Coates, Nigel Chaffee, who is our plant expert, and Dion Warner, who's a volunteer guide and knows everything about the wildlife around here, so he's going to help us find what we want to find.
And what's special about this site that we're exploring today?
Well, it is one of the icons of Somerset Levels, really. It is a fantastic place. It's just like the Amazon. If you look at this water feature here, with all the little islands and all the dead trees in them, which you can, if you walk along here quietly, see kingfishers on there because they'll be here fishing. There's loads and loads of fish in the water. The dragonflies here are absolutely amazing.
So this is a question from Jenny Melling, and she asks, how can I deal with the seeming impossibility of knowing the whole truth?
Okay, so the whole truth, that's pretty much everything. Is there a case of understanding the whole as an individual plant?
A plant as an individual will have its own perceptions and its own senses, so it can gather a certain amount of information.
They can see things, they can detect light, they can detect how much light there is, they can detect the quality of light, so red and far red wavelength ratios, which affect how they grow and respond in that. They can taste things, and I think taste is basically chemicals dissolved on your tongue, so they're actually tasting chemicals in the soil. They are touch sensitive. You know, if you touch a plant, it will actually respond. Anyone who's grown runner beans in the garden will know that they can detect the stakes you put in. They will respond with that. The touch sensitivity will encourage them to bind around and actually attach themselves. They can hear things. There is this wonderful mechanism of buzz pollination, particularly in some members of the potato family, which require this appropriate frequency of a visiting insect, say it's a bee, and that frequency is sufficient to actually agitate the pollen grains in the stamens. They come out, get on the bee, that bee then transfers them somewhere else. So that to me is a pretty good sense and appreciation of sound. They can smell things. A lot of chemicals are in the environment which they can actually detect.
Obviously, we're standing underneath this amazing spreading oak tree with its branches reaching out towards other trees and its roots reaching out towards other trees. And it'd be really interesting to think a bit more about how different species of plant in a woodland like this might interact and communicate with each other in order to know more than they might be able to do as an individual plant.
One of the things I think a lot of people are quite excited about at the moment is this concept of what's called the wood wide web. What you've actually got is a fantastic network of connections between trees via the fungi to other trees, and that can extend throughout the whole forest. So a lot of the fungi are all around us, just out of sight, because they're basically beneath our feet in the soil. And there's a lot of evidence now that this seems to be a fairly general global phenomenon. Information does seem to flow via those fungal connections, tree to other types of plant.
So we're standing here amongst a woodland of birch and elder and honeysuckle growing up through it, and bracken and all sorts of different species. And they're all in some way talking to each other through this underground network.
Yeah, it's interesting. The question implies there's a potential for understanding the whole truth on an individual basis. But I think what we've been talking about is the idea of this collective truth, understanding a truth through your community, or understanding the knowledge of your situation in the world through the community.
Mm. I suppose even within a diverse community, perhaps there's no access to the whole truth. What does that mean? But there, you can increase your knowledge, you can increase your access to information, can't you?
We've come into this very open meadowland, sort of wet meadowland, with some mature trees in the fringes. I think it's probably time to have another question.
It's an anonymous question, and it's, I am an 18 stone woman, and I've been this weight for most of my adult life. I've repeatedly tried diets, but to no avail. What would the plants suggest I do? I suppose I would start by thinking about how plants eat, which is obviously different to us because of their ability to eat sunlight.
Yeah, I think that puts it very well. I mean, their mode of nutrition is, it's very complicated if you get into all the details of how it works, but it's very, very straightforward in many respects. They take carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, water, particularly from the soil, use sunlight as an energy source, and it's all basically brought together via the chlorophyll, this wonderful green material they have in their leaves particularly. That's why we'd call the plant kingdom the green plants. But then they make their sugars, and of course that wonderful waste product, oxygen. You know, most of the oxygen in the atmosphere is generated by photosynthesis of green plants. But that doesn't work for all plants. There are a number of different diets, if you like, another number of different ways plants get their food. And hopefully we can look at some of those special relationships, often special additional relationships, today. Oh, Dad, mind your foot. Got a clump here of eyebright. Right, we've got green leaves, it's photosynthetic, but this one is what's described as being a hemiparasite. So what it actually is doing, it's plumbing in its root system into the root system of another species, and it's able to get extra water, particularly from that source. It's got green leaves, so it's probably self-sufficient in terms of photosynthesis, but a way of supplementing perhaps water by tapping in literally to the water supply and hard work of another plant.
So it's stealing nutrition, really?
Why not? Yeah, I think that's you can't sort of dress it up any other way. So it's another strategy. So again, if you can't perhaps get your own, get somebody else's.
So can a plant suffer if there's too much of something in terms of nutrition?
If you had a field, they're called sort of semi-improved pastures, where perhaps you've had lots of nutrients added to them for the farming regime, in terms of species diversity, it's very poor. And very few plant individuals, then very few species of insects and what have you. So everything suffers.
So we're entering a different area now, which is full of much taller reeds and wetland, in search of a rather special plant.
That's quite wet underfoot here. What have we got here, dear?
There is a sundew, and there is the flower point just coming up in the flower. Here are the leaves, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, so 7 leaves. And as you can see, they've got these little spikes on the end of them where they, instead of pitching them, they just close up and then just stay closed until the insect is absorbed into the body of the plant.
So they look quite red.
Yes, they are. That's to attract the insects, I guess.
Okay. So, but the red is coming from the hairs rather than
Yes.
So it's almost like a mixture of green and red when you first look at it.
Yeah.
And they're sort of almost like little round spadey shapes, aren't they? Mm.
They're tiny.
Yeah,
they are.
So Nigel, what's special about the sundew? What are we looking at here?
This will actually actively attract and devour insects in particular. It's one of these carnivorous plants. Wonderful, special plants. And sundew, because the sun is sort of sparkling off the dew, which is actually a secretion produced by the plant that's very sticky, potentially attractive to the insects. They get on the leaves, they're just modified leaves with these wonderful tentacles, they get stuck. And in some species, certainly once you've got a struggling insect there, some of the other tentacles actually move. They will bend in towards the insect and help to trap it even further.
Can we see any that have actually got insects captured in their hairs?
There's one there close.
Yes, there's quite a few.
Oh yeah.
We've just found some sundews here with 3 damselflies attached to them. They've demolished one by the looks of it.
So there's something in the sundew that attaches to the insect and sucks it. And is it chemicals in it that just slowly digest it?
So the stickiness of the dew, that basically traps the insects, but the digestion is done by enzymes. They are released in response to the sort of insects being caught by the plant itself, and they will digest the insect.
It's a high protein diet, isn't it?
The Atkins?
Maybe not the Atkins diet exactly, but definitely remarkably high in protein for most plants.
Well, I mean, now you've mentioned that, perhaps looking at the range of nutrition that's available to plants and the way they access it could well give us insights into new diets for humans.
Well, there's certainly a move towards eating more insects, isn't there?
Well, that's true, yes. I like that's a lovely link. Yes, beautiful. Crunchy crickets, anyone?
The yellow flower.
Oh,
it is really
lovely.
Sweet, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is this treadable or no?
Sure it's probably quite steep and.
It's good. See him in the drink any minute.
No.
don't do that to me, Leon.
We're precariously perched on the edge of this ditch waterway, Rhine Rhine, here at West Sedgemoor, in quite a different habitat than we've experienced before. And Dion has spotted this quite distinct yellow flower.
Yes, yellow flower, called bladderwort.
So what's special about bladderwort?
What this one has, it has tiny bladders, hence the name bladderwort. They're little tiny vacuums. Now there's a hair just outside this structure. When that's activated, perhaps by a water flea or other tiny invertebrate in the water being carried to it, it activates the trap. The door opens, the flask itself is under negative pressure, so water rushes in and takes in with it that tiny invertebrate. The door closes, and what you've got, it's, if you imagine a tiny goldfish bowl which is totally sealed, and you have this thing swimming around, but it doesn't swim around for long. It's a wonderful example of a very specialised plant for, again, a very special habitat.
It seems like they're finding strategies individually to offset the problems of certain environments, aren't they? So the specialists for these difficult habitats have found these interesting ways, almost a supplement, like we might take a food supplement, for the nutritional deficits in their diet. So it's not a one-size-fits-all situation for how to be healthy and fit into an ecology or find the right diet for you or find the right exercise plan for you. It's about, it might be something quite peculiar.
And individual. Even what works for most people might not work for you. So it's about finding your own strategy, your own niche in this culture of well-being.
So we're going to deal with a new question from Luminara, and she asks, how can I stay in my tenderness as I navigate my career in a competitive and precarious world? So how can I stay in my tenderness? So I suppose it's about how plants might remain tender. So obviously they're very tender as they emerge as seedlings.
As the plant gets older, it develops more mature tissues and actually literally toughens up. And I think it's that resilience, that hardening, thickening that is necessary to actually enable them to cope with slings and arrows and the outrageous fortune of nature and all the environmental factors. So they're starting off tender, but I think to survive they do need to develop that fairly tough exterior.
Are there examples of any plants then that are able or necessarily retain some element of tenderness?
Yeah, I think to some extent there's probably a bit of a difference between animals and plants, that plants do have these continually growing points. So the tips of the shoots, the tips of the roots, constantly growing, or relatively tender, and the bits further back are actually toughening up to enable them to get bigger, to cope with the things in the environment.
Hopefully, I think that's what the questioner is asking, is, you know, actually wanting to have the protective strength against the slings and arrows, as you put it, of her career or whatever, but also to find those points at which you can allow some softness, some flexibility, some space for new ideas or new growth.
Okay, we've stopped. We're on the edge of what's the Somerset term for these ditches?
Rhines is the word I was always taught. Rhines, R-H-Y-N-E-S. Now, I don't know, is it a very local name, Dion?
Yes.
So it's Rhine. Real.
Rhines.
Rhines, we call them Rhines up in North Somerset.
Here, down here is Rhines.
So we're looking at some reed mace plants, which are what I always thought of as being bulrushes, but I'm told that's the wrong name. But they have the big cattail seed heads, flower heads.
Develop into the seed heads in due course. You know, it is just like an enormous cat's tail, which is a very good description of the flower head.
About 6 foot high, would you say? Maybe even taller?
Yeah, 8-9 foot probably. So really quite statuesque plant, quite dramatic.
And these have a very specific way of keeping spaces open within their structures to allow for oxygen to pass down through their system, is that right?
The roots are in the sediment at the bottom of the Rhine-Rhine ditch or sluice. It's very difficult getting enough oxygen from the water that actually surrounds them in that waterlogged sediment. So they've got this very, very cunning adaptation. Inside the root, there are air spaces. They connect with the air spaces above ground, above water in the stems. What you've got there is a good example of a pretty robust, quite resilient plant suffering and dealing with the environment. But these very quite tender bits which are actually sacrificed, they do collapse to allow the rest of the plant to get the oxygen to actually survive and compete and hold its head really quite high above the water level.
It's almost quite literally, you know, finding breathing space, isn't it, within those competitive arenas and allowing that kind of oxygen into your system.
So those breathing spaces are soft, they're not hardened up, but also they're quite vulnerable, those spaces, because they're not covered in a hard skin in a sense. They're open to the elements, they're open to disease perhaps. So if we go back to the question,
how can I stay in my tenderness as I navigate my career? So I think it is finding these spaces to stay open, isn't it? Finding spaces to stay vulnerable.
What do you mean by spaces?
Well, within one's time or... I mean, I suppose in terms of oxygen, it's quite interesting. I suppose in terms of meditative practices or, you know, breathing techniques that a lot of people use these days in order to become more mindful or calming.
I was also thinking about retaining some sort of sense of vulnerability, rather than toughening and hardening up and putting this protective skin on that we all do as we get older. There is some element of you which is still fairly childlike, retaining that. So it's maybe, some innocence perhaps even, or some playfulness.
I think that's a very nice way of putting it. So, yeah, reasonably tough so that you can actually survive, but not so tough that you're totally sclerotic and hard-hearted. So you do retain that inner core of tenderness so you can empathise.
OK, we've got another question here.
Can the plants explain, considering the supposed wisdom of hindsight, how we are seeing a new rise of extremist views, and can they advise on a positive response?
But they're always there, surely. It's not just now, they're always there. Just the rise of extremist views are cyclical in a way.
Yeah, I think probably that's true. So I suppose we can think of it in terms of some other kind of parasitic relationship on a plant that overwhelms something.
Yeah, some sort of threat. How do communities or colonies of plants deal with threat?
Yeah, I think that's an appropriate way of trying to interpret the question, because plants, as far as we know, don't go in for the sort of political malarkey, which the extremist views might actually suggest. So I think some extreme events, some extreme challenges in the environment that they have to face, how do they do that? So perhaps we can find an example which might give us a way into talking about that aspect.
Okay, this we've come across this plant that's pretty ravaged. What is this plant, Dion, do you think?
This plant is a dock, just a common dock. It's been attacked by a certain beetle, and it's taken all the soft tissues off of the actual plant. All that's left is just the leaf veins and the main stems. Everything else is gone.
So this is quite a severe event for this dock, and if we're looking around, we can see they're not all suffering like this, are they?
Some of the others that are fairly close by, the soft bits of their leaves have been eaten, but their flowers look okay. So clearly this one that's sort of at the front of the group, is the most destroyed. There's not much left here other than withered stem.
So this individual obviously lost the fight, but the community of docks, is there any sense that they can combat this threat in some way?
What you've got, again, is a very good example with some plants. I don't know how widespread it is amongst different species, but certainly some plants, when they are under threat, possibly by a herbivore, something chomping on their leaves, not very nice for them. They're going to lose that tissue, that ability to photosynthesize in those parts. But some of them, the chemistry of the plants actually change in response to that attack. And they release chemicals which get into the atmosphere. Of course, in the atmosphere, they can diffuse away. So they diffuse away from the harmed individual and can be detected by other individuals of the same species of the plant. And what they're able to do is actually change their chemistry so that if they do get attacked, perhaps by that herbivore in due course, they are better able to defend themselves. So there's some sort of resilience, a signal's gone out from that damaged one. In some cases, it's not only individuals of the same species which can detect that signal and react to it appropriately, but other species which would normally compete with the species that's being attacked may also detect that signal, respond appropriately, and protect themselves from further attacks.
It shows us, you know, these events are better tackled by working together.
And maybe acting quite quickly as well, responding to that call.
The quicker you can respond to something like that, hopefully the better it can be contained and the better for the greater majority.